Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a story that keeps coming back to haunt us, and that is the perennial euro crisis, now growing worse by the day while Europe's policymakers enjoy their long August vacation. Dimitri Papadimitriou, the president of the Levy Economics Institute, joins us to discuss the accelerating run on the euro as citizens in poorer nations move their money to Germany, making it impossible for Greece, Spain, Portugal, Italy, and Ireland to cover their losses. Then we'll look into the latest report by the Pew Research Center that finds the American middle class has shrunk by 10% from 1971 to 2010, while only the upper income group has increased their share of the national wealth up to 46% from 29% in 1971. Meanwhile, the lower income group rose 29% of all adults, up from 25%. Branko Milanović, a lead economist with the World Bank and author of The Haves and Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality, joins us. Then finally, we will speak with George Farrar, who is the founder and executive director of Open Debates, an organization working to reform the presidential debates. We will discuss how the Republican and Democratic parties took the debates away from the nonpartisan League of Women Voters and have since rigged the system to weaken the format, limit the number of debates, and exclude third-party candidates. And joining us now is Dimitri Papadimitriou, the president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has testified on a number of occasions in hearings of Senate and House of Representatives committees of the U.S. Congress and was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress and was a member of the Competitive Policy Council's Subcouncil on Capital Allocation. He has an article in The Nation, Europe's Highway to Hell. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dimitri Papadimitriou.
Thank you very much.
And we've spoken quite a bit over the last few years, and it feels like Groundhog Day. You know, we're back again, but talking about the fate of the euro and, by extension, the fate of President Obama in the sense that Angela Merkel, who Forbes magazine just named as the most powerful woman in the world a second year in a row, seems to hold his fate in her hands in as much as she holds the fate of the euro, but everybody's on vacation, I take it, in August, and there's a run on the euro.
Well, there is absolutely correct what you say, and that actually indicates how leadership is wanting in the European community. What we know is that both Angela Merkel and those who are responsible in running the European institutions in Brussels don't really have a clue what to do. They have started this crisis. They haven't handled it right. And it continues to be a problem, which at the end, either we will see the dissolution of the euro or perhaps what is most desirable is to see a federal union along the lines of the United States of America. That's the only way United States of Europe can work, where a currency will become a currency of a nation, as opposed to each member state government to be divorced from its currency, which is the largest experiment that has ever been attempted. And as we see, the results are not very encouraging.
But as we speak, Europe's in the midst of a massive run on bank deposits in Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and Ireland. And it's all but impossible for the banks in these countries to cover the losses that are ballooning national deficits and debt to levels that we've never seen before.
You know, this was actually pointed out by someone in 1997. This is a perfect situation where by having a run on the banks, you will end up having one bank actually accumulating all the reserves, and all the other central banks from which the runs are being performed, you will have deficits will have to be covered by the European Central Bank. So the balance sheet of the European Central Bank has this assets, so to speak, of the liabilities of the other national central banks. But of course, we will get stuck with the bill because the regional national banks don't have the capacity to print their own money. So since ECB is the only bank that can print money, it's basically going to get stuck. And who is the major government or the major country in the European Union? Germany. So Germany is actually going to get the bill. And since they know they will get the bill, they are not interested in getting the bill. So this is why most people see a doomsday for the euro.
So in other words, the German banks are getting the money, right, from Spain and Italy. Yes. Spain is
That's
just
where the deposits are being made. Right.
And for the last 5 months, as you point out in your article in The Nation, Papadimitriou, Europe's highway to hell, that in the last 5 months of this year, about 163 billion euros have left Spanish banks for German banks. So Germany's getting the money, but they're not going to pay the bill.
They can't pay the bill. Up to the end of May, they had accumulated over 720 billion reserves. This is Target 2 reserves. That, you know, they're on the mirror image of this are in minuses in other national central banks. So the ECB has trillions of these extensions. And if these countries have a banking system which is on the brink, you know, of course, who's going to get stuck with the bill? And that's why it is most important that to avoid having this bank run is to have a pan-European deposit insurance along the lines that we have in the United States. Therefore, if you do that, there's no difference between a German euro, a Greek euro, or a Spanish euro. Now, everyone knows that the Greek euro is not worth the same as the German euro, or the same as the Spanish euro, or the French euro. So you have these differences, and the only way you can avoid that is if you have a deposit insurance covering all European banks. It will eliminate the bank runs overnight. Of course, Germany is refusing to do this, because if the banks, in effect, in Greece, go bankrupt, they will get stuck with the bill. Because they guarantee the deposit insurance if it's pan-European and Germany is the strongest economy, of course, they will get stuck with the bill. And that's the problem.
But it's so logical that if you're a Greek holding Greek euros or a Spaniard holding Spanish euros, and you know that that they're depreciating by the day, but if you can then deposit them in a German bank and they won't depreciate, it's no wonder there's a run going on.
Absolutely. But that is how the system was actually by design. It has a flawed design. And therefore, they should have known that it was pointed out to them. But somehow they thought that this was going to be the first step. The second step would be a fiscal union and ultimately a political union. But, you know, they stopped at a monetary union. You cannot have a monetary union without a fiscal union. And you cannot have a fiscal union along the lines of Chancellor Merkel, which is that every single member state has to balance its books and it has to have trade surpluses. Every country cannot have a trade surplus unless countries have trade deficits, unless you expect that trade deficits would occur outside of the Eurozone, which is a fallacy, and it's actually a naive notion to make. And this is how it was originally set up, in a very naive setup. And, you know, Germans do believe that, unfortunately, there's no spectacular leadership in Germany. It's in very short supply. And things become worse when you hear pronouncements coming from the vice chancellor who says, well, we are prepared with the Greek exit. Well, the markets are not prepared for the Greek exit of the euro, and that's why we see the choppy waters that's happening in the markets.
Again, I'm speaking with Dimitri Papadimitriou, the president of the Levy Economics Institute and the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has an article and the nation, Europe's highway to hell. And of course, you talk about a lack of leadership. Nevertheless, Forbes magazine, for a second year in a row, have named German Chancellor Angela Merkel as the most powerful woman in the world, the Iron Lady of Europe. She, of course, is meeting with President François Hollande of France and is about to meet the Greek Prime Minister, Antonis Samaras, following Hollande to Berlin tomorrow, and then travel on to Paris on August the 25th. So at least they're not on vacation, right?
They can't, you know. But on the other hand, these meetings, I think they're it's bad theater. You know, the Greek Prime Minister knows that he has to do whatever is possible to convince them that they need to ease the terms. And I think at the end they will ease the terms, given the fact that the Greek economy will be experiencing a almost 7%, even higher decline in GDP, which means it is the fifth year of a recession. It is really depression. It is not possible to meet those obligations. So they also will realize, because they're not prepared really for Greece to leave the euro. They have no idea what the repercussions will be, and they don't know whether Spain will follow. Spain is a big hot potato, and unfortunately they don't really know how to deal with it, because the Spanish prime minister represents a big country. And therefore, after him, it is Italy. So they have no idea what it is, despite these silly pronouncements that are being made by Philip Rosler, who I don't think has a clue what he's talking about.
Now, tell me who he is.
He is the Vice Chancellor of Germany.
Oh, the Vice Chancellor of Germany. So, right. So Dimitri Papadimitriou, everything that you've talked about in terms of these meetings and kicking the can down the road and giving Greece, leaving the door open to more concessions for Greece, none of this seems to be dealing with the central problem, which you've written about in your article and which we've been discussing here today, and that is the run on the euro.
Yes. That is not going to solve the problem, but I think what will solve the problem is basically to be able to make the pronouncements and to make the European institutions really know what it means to have a monetary union and ultimately a fiscal union, which means you cannot insist on the austerity measures for all these countries. Because even if these countries, even if Greece, for instance, turns around and has a primary surplus, which will achieve, it cannot service that debt. That debt is now at over 153% as of the end of June, and it is growing. It is not possible to service it. We see that Spain, that has a much smaller debt and has very high interest rates. You know, the interest rates go down with some pronouncement from Mr. Draghi that he will do whatever it needs to be done in order to save the euro. And then there's a German pronouncement that says, well, we're not going to go along with that. We're not going to allow the ECB to buy indiscriminately bonds from Spain or bonds from Italy. And then the markets go back again and the interest rates go up. So it is a mixture of policy from people who basically are extremely naive. And one would have thought politicians are really smart or shrewd. And I think there's a very much short supply in Europe.
Well, in terms of confidence in the market and shoring up confidence in the market, yesterday Angela Merkel said in Moldova that we won't find solutions on Friday. So, I mean, to me, that's the opposite of... I mean, when are they going to find solutions?
I don't know whether we'll find solutions. This is why everybody is actually scratching their heads, because it is impossible to see that such a lack of leadership. And, you know, it's not only actually that one sees in the Eurozone. It's even outside of the Eurozone. I mean, Poland and Estonia and others who really are aspiring to go to join the Eurozone are making pronouncements that we should be very hard towards those countries that have not carried out the reforms that they've agreed to carry out. And even though the entire Eurozone is actually in recession, even Germany only shows 0.3% of growth. Now, this is not growth. Think about how much exports they have, and they still have this low anemic growth. So things are very bad. So I'm not so sure I can answer your question when it will happen. It will happen only when a big country such as Spain or Italy raises the specter of leaving the euro.
So we already know from the U.S. economy, which is not doing well but doing better than Europe, that the big drag on the U.S. economy, interestingly enough, is, for example, with Ford and GM having substantial profits here at home but having to offset profits with massive losses in their plants in Europe.
In Europe, absolutely. But one thing we can say about America is that at least the financial sector in America has delevered from the European exposure. Now, the real economy, of course, will have repercussions, and that's why we see the financial markets in the United States responding to the difficulties in Europe. But at least to some extent, we know that our financial system is not in any jeopardy. The international financial system might be in jeopardy. Therefore, the Federal Reserve will step in and extend swap agreements and so on. But the fact is that's not a solution. It's a Band-Aid, and it's exactly what you said earlier, kicking the can on the road. But, you know, the road now is becoming steeper. So it's very difficult to keep kicking the road. It's not really on the incline that it is appropriate to have an easy kicking down the road.
So, Dmitry Papadimitriou, give us a time frame. I mean, obviously, the White House is nervous as a cat that Netanyahu is going to attack Iran, and that could have...
My expectation is that subsequent to the beginning, or at least in a couple of weeks, when we were in September, and everybody's back from vacation, and we have the looming November election of the United States, where I can see Tim Geithner and others traveling to Europe to begin to establish more pressure for a solution, at least to not affect the November U.S. elections.
So in other words...
Whether they'll be able to have a solution that would make sense, it's not clear.
So in other words, we don't know whether Netanyahu is bluffing or he really doesn't plan on attacking Iran. We know that that would probably have detrimental effects for the White House.
Absolutely.
But we do know more about Europe. We do know that the clock is really ticking on how long this, and this bank run will continue to accelerate, won't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The expectation is that sometime in September, Spain will ask for a bailout.
So, and that's when you say that'll get Merkel's attention.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. But you point out in your article in The Nation, Europe's Highway to Hell, Dmitry Papadimitriou, that Europe's trip down the highway to hell began with this original sin, which is, of course, what we were talking about earlier, with having this common currency, but no means for each country to balance its books, if you will.
Right.
And give us some sense then about what you think could be done. I know you've got some proposals here how to counteract this disaster.
I expect that if indeed cooler heads prevail, that there will be a federation of states as we are in the United States, with a federal U.S. Treasury, which will report to the European Parliament. And the Europarlament will have a much bigger budget than the 1% that it now controls, something of the order of the United States, which is close to 15 to 20%. Then things will be different, and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development will begin for some growth projects, some euro bonds for growth projects, and starting to get actually the European Union in what it ought to be, as opposed to what they think it is now. I think that they understand, and it's a question of, you know, it's plain chicken, who is actually going to move first.
Well, isn't that what the Germans have been doing all along?
I mean, yes, but I think the end of the game is very close.
So what's happening, though, in terms of atmospherics between the two countries? Because in the Greek press, there's been some scathing comparisons to the Nazi occupation of Greece during World War II and the current economic crisis and the extent to which they feel, the Greeks feel, the Germans are putting the screws to them. And also you had, as you mentioned, the deputy chancellor, more or less saying that Greece can drop off the cliff. Is that going to quieten down, or is that going to get worse?
I thought unless there's a real solution, it would actually get worse. People are basically fed up with all these austerity measures, and they don't see any recognition that after, you know, the GDP in Greece has actually declined by 20%. People have lost fortunes. People don't have increased poverty to over 30%. Unemployment is skyrocketing. You know, there's a limit to how much people will accept. And therefore, you will expect some hostilities between the southern Europe and the northern part of Europe. Because it's not only Germany. The Netherlands are the same, and Finland. The representatives from Finland respond the same way, not only to Greece, but also to Spain. So I don't think this is going to continue.
Well, just in closing, this is all, most of it comes from the fact that banks made bad loans, and the countries out of which these banks operate got stuck with the bill. It happened in Ireland first with a bad real estate loan. It happened in Spain with a real estate bubble. I think the situation in Greece is somewhat different. But at the end of the day, this is all about bailing out banks. And the banks get off scot-free. I suppose the same thing happened here with the 2008 crash. But the people get screwed. I mean, is that equation ever going to change?
No, it won't change, unfortunately, because we don't have a good regulatory structure. You're absolutely right what you said. Banks extended loans to countries because they thought that the risk was the same as if they were extending to Germany, as if they were extending to France, because they thought that with the euro, the countries are going to converge. It is true that inflation did converge. We have a very low inflation. But the real economy, the real variables, unemployment, growth, and the rest, did not converge. And therefore, since ultimately the loans had been extended to for the capital development of a real economy, if the real economy is not doing well, the risk is different. And therefore, this is what happened, underpricing the risk, and now we have to basically bail out the banks because they underpriced risk, and exactly what we did in the United States with the mortgage-backed securities. No different.
Well, Dimitri Papadimitriou, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dimitri Papadimitriou, the president of the Levy Economics Institute and the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has testified on a number of occasions in hearings of Senate and House of Representatives committees of the U.S. Congress and was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission and was a member of the Competitiveness Policy Council Subcommittee on Capital Allocation. He has an article in The Nation, Europe's Highway to Hell. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment talking about the Pew study that indicates that the middle class has shrunk, the rich have gotten richer, and the poor have gotten poorer.
And full of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Branko Milanović, who is a lead economist with the World Bank's research group and a visiting professor at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His work focuses on income distribution, poverty, and political economy of reform. He's the author of The Haves and the Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality. Welcome to Background Briefing, Branko Milanović.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be there.
And Branko, this study by the Pew Research Center, it's come out following a recent study by the Federal Reserve indicating how the American middle class, which is the sort of, the core, if you will, of the American dream. In fact, just in summary, the Pew study finds that overall the middle class is now smaller, poorer, and more pessimistic than they have ever been. We can get into some of the statistics, which I read in the opening, that the middle class has shrunk by 10% from 1971 to 2010, while the upper income group has increased their share of national wealth to 46%, up from 29% in 1971. And meanwhile, the lower income group rose to 29% of all adults, up from 25%. So there you have a pretty stark picture, do you not, of a country that is more unequal and growing more unequal.
Yes, it is true. It's actually, of course, confirming what, you know, many people knew, because it is not exactly new trend. It is a trend, as you mentioned, actually, which started even in the early 70s. So it is being exacerbated probably over the last 10 years. And of course, people have noticed it more now with the crisis. But it is a trend which exists for now almost 40 years, and which leads to polarization of incomes. Many people who used to be middle class have become poor. Some of them have also become richer. But what is, I think, very important for the country is that the fact that the middle, the core number of people who are like between the two extremes has been shrinking. And obviously that's something which I think for many people is a source of great concern.
And your book, The Haves and the Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality, dealt with the global picture as well as the United States. There was one story that I covered recently by an economist who had done a study on offshore funds, tax havens, how much money's out there. And this is money that's not just the richest Americans parking their money, although it's a big chunk of it. There's also global kleptocrats and criminals. The figure was $21 to $32 trillion of money is being hidden in tax havens. That is also, I think, a part of this broader picture where more and more wealth is being creamed off the top, but it's not being put to any productive use by the look of it.
That's true, actually. So I wanted basically to make two points. The first one is that what people maybe don't realize all the time is that what is happening in the United States, of course, is also happening elsewhere in the world. But in the U.S., particularly since it's lasted for about 30 years, it has been much stronger trend than elsewhere. So in that sense, what we see with polarization of incomes in the U.S. is a little bit of an outlier, but it's not still, I think, which is totally out of ordinary compared to the other countries. But it's an outlier. So it's actually just that the tendencies are worse or more exacerbated in the U.S. The second point, exactly going back to what you were talking about, the wealth that we don't even know about, because even in the Pew study or even household surveys or even in the fiscal revenues, these are actually amounts of money that are essentially hidden. So all the statistics that we talk about don't take into account, actually none of the statistics that we're talking about takes into account the wealth which is hidden elsewhere. It's basically wealth which is hidden from the tax authorities, from obviously enumerators of surveys, or from anybody who tries to find out, you know, distribution of income and wealth. So in other words, the income inequality statistics are worse than what we see.
So in other words, the rich have gotten richer, but they're probably a lot richer than we know because they're hiding a lot of their money. And that, of course, is one of the questions that's come up about Mitt Romney and his offshore tax havens. And it, of course, comes out of the questions a lot of people have is why he won't release his tax returns.
Well, you know, I don't know. Of course, by definition, it is impossible to know how much money there is there, because that's money that is parked there in these accounts with intention to be hidden. So people who are economists or people who work on income distribution like myself, they use official data and the data that are sort of available that we get from surveys. And incomes or wealth, which is hidden, is by definition unknown. But we can speculate on the amounts. Putting a number on that is very difficult. But one thing that we definitely know is that these amounts are probably very large. And if they were included, the statistics that we know would become actually worse.
Again, I'm speaking with Branko Milanović, who's a lead economist in the World Bank Research Group and is a visiting professor at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His work focuses on income distribution, poverty, and political economy of reform, and he's the author of The Haves and Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality. And we're talking about the report just issued by the Pew Research Center that basically finds that the middle class in America is shrinking, the rich are getting richer, and the poor are getting poorer and more numerous. And since 2000, the median income for America's middle class has fallen from $72,956 to $69,487, the Pew researchers found. But net worth plummeted over that period, with the median declining by 28%, erasing two decades of gains. Of course, a lot of this is because of the housing bubble and the extent to which most middle-class people's biggest investment are their homes. Are there any indications that that will ever return? Because there's an awful lot of people treading water and there's an awful lot of people underwater.
That's true. And, you know, however sort of worrying this is, and, of course, we don't know when it will return, because it might take 10 years for the net wealth to return to the levels where it was in 2007. But one thing which I think is even more worrying is the fact, the one that you mentioned, that the middle class's average income has been stagnant or declining over the last 10 or even 20 years. So, in other words, we have had a decade of lost growth for the middle class. So we have really basically two unfavorable developments. We have stagnant income for a majority of people, which is like 50% or even 60% of the population. And then on the other hand, we have a decline in net wealth among those people. So both developments, I think, are actually very bad. And one has really trouble seeing when it would get better. But I think that it is really the income part, which I think is more more worrying even than the wealth part.
So does this point to anything that is inexorable? I mean, in human development over the millennia, is it inevitable that societies evolve into oligarchies, or are the trends identifiable and reversible? Okay.
Yes, it's, of course, it's a huge question. We don't really, you know, it's very difficult to say that. I don't think it's inevitable. And even without going back to thousands of years or hundreds of years, actually, if you just look at the U.S. experience over the last, 60 years, you, of course, see these trends, which have been very different from the trends today. I mean, if you look at what happened since World War II and until mid-1970s, you had exactly the opposite developments from today. You had an increased share of the middle class, much more people who became part of the middle class, and you had rising incomes of the middle class. So we had really exactly the opposite of the situation today. And that's why I don't think that there is any inevitability as such, because within the lifespan of a person, we have seen these two waves, one way which actually brought most people up, and the other way which actually sort of kept many people at the same level where they were before and actually was very good for one small group of people.
So therefore, it directly relates to politics and to representational politics, right? If you have politicians and policies that represent the broader American middle class and working America, you have better results for middle class and working America. And if you have governments that represent only the rich, you have better results for them. Is that the answer?
Well, I think partly I think this is true. It is absolutely true that if certain policy measures in the last maybe quarter of a century have been directed towards the sort of improving the position of the rich, because obviously the rich also had much greater influence on the political process, I think it is true. And many people have pointed out that the political process has become much more dominated by the rich than it was the case in the 40s, 50s, or 60s, and 70s, and so forth. Now, of course, the economists also have to mention that, of course, there are other forces like globalization and technological change, which really do not depend on politics, and which also, to some extent, have gone in favor of the rich. So we do have political forces, which I think are pro-rich, but we might have also economic forces, which are pro-rich as well. But you might actually argue that in an ideal world, political forces would tend to offset the economic forces so that the middle class does not lose ground.
But, Branko Milanović, the idea that the wealthy in this country can say it's not us, it's globalization, isn't that a part of a broader problem? Well, it may not be a problem to the wealthy, but it seems as a problem in many ways. It seems like the fulfillment of Adam Smith's vision that capital will transcend sovereignty. Hasn't that already happened? We just talked about the hidden wealth of this world's, the global super rich, of between $21 and $32 trillion in tax havens. That's transnational. Big corporations are transnational, and they park a lot of their profits abroad, and they don't get taxed on them. So, is this another part of the picture? The extent to which, our plutocrats, our millionaires and billionaires, aren't necessarily operating under the American flag.
Well, this is true. You know, these are, however, forces which I'm actually personally in favor, not obviously of the people sort of transcending and hiding their wealth. But, you know, the forces of globalization, I think, are forces that are inevitable and they're actually on balance good. What I think is a problem is that these forces which are destabilizing or some groups of people have to be, in a better world, would have to be offset by political measures that actually try to sort of make the impact of forces of globalization less on the middle class and the poor. So that's where politics comes into the picture. So I don't think that politics would be very useful in trying to actually go against the prevalent forces of globalization and movement of capital and trade and so forth. But it has to locally, domestically, or nationally help those who lose out. And I think that has not happened in the last 20 years.
And is there any explanation in terms of the size of countries? In other words, the United States is a big and complex country. Some of the countries that have higher standards of living for their citizens, a greater safety net, social democratic countries like Sweden and Scandinavian countries, Germany, Australia, New Zealand. Is it because they're smaller countries that they can take better care of their people? Is that a reason?
Well, people, of course, argue this is true. Actually, I agree with you. There is a little bit of that U.S. exceptionalism because U.S. obviously is a huge country. It has more than 300 million people. People are very diverse. You have lots of immigration. You have, you know, different types of people, high-skilled, very high-skilled, and very low-skilled. You have really centers like Silicon Valley or Hollywood and so on, and you have also Rust Belt. And so it's a very diverse country. And maybe we could allow for higher maybe inequality and lesser distribution than in Sweden or Norway, which are very homogeneous societies. But as I said before, you know, if you compare U.S. today, if you compare U.S. with United States 30 years ago, the situation was very different. And it's not that the country has changed in such a way that it is unrecognizable. It is really that the politics have changed and forces of globalization have contributed to that too. So U.S. exceptionalism, yes, I would accept it, I think, to some extent, but it cannot be the entire explanation.
So, Branko Milanović, again, the lead economist of the World Bank's research group and a visiting professor at the School of Advanced international studies at Johns Hopkins University and the author of The Haves and Have-Nots, A Brief Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality. Of course, starting on Monday with the Republican Convention, we're going to see lots and lots of flags. We're going to see lots of patriotism. Everybody be wrapping themselves in the flag, and we'll hear all kinds of patriotic jingoism, and we'll hear the same from the Democrats the following week. But do you think we'll ever hear anything from any of these people questioning some of what we're talking about, whether or not we still have an economy, whether it's become a plutonomy, whether we still have a democracy or our democracy has been captured by an oligarchy, which the objective facts seem to indicate is the case?
Well, I don't know, of course, if it would be questioned. I sort of doubt, because obviously the political process depends on money, and then by questioning that, you're implicitly, of course, questioning people who are contributing to you. But I think it is indeed a problem. The problem is, as the Pew report shows, is the shrinking middle class, and I think, as other people have argued, it's a greater political influence of the rich. So I think these two problems may not be mentioned at either convention, but they are not going to go away.
Well, the Pew study does deal, and you would think that this study would be a bombshell that Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan would be running away from, and conversely, Barack Obama and Joe Biden would be jumping all over. We'll wait to see whether that's the case. But the Pew study did say that 62% of the respondents to the study said a lot of the blame lay with Congress. About 54% blamed the banks and financial institutions. 47% said the same about large corporations. And more people blamed the previous Bush administration, 44%, than those that blamed the Obama administration, 34%. So the Pew study, which is obviously nonpartisan, they nevertheless, I think, show you some political outcomes there.
Well, they do. And, of course, the question is whether these results, which are actually quite striking, will be not necessarily now, but maybe either now or maybe in 4 years' time, will be translated into political process. Because what we have seen, I think, so far is a certain amount of disconnect between sort of disappointment or unhappiness among many people, and people blaming either government or the banks or the financial sector, and so forth, and disconnect between that unhappiness and discontent and the political process, because the political process does not seem to have still accepted, or maybe people who are unhappy have not been able to influence political process in the way that they should, in principle.
So just in closing, Branko Milanovic, is that to say that when people are under stress, like the American middle class that shrunk by 10% and lost a huge amount of its wealth in the last decades, 28% of its wealth has been erased in 2 decades, is that to say that victims of being downsized are less politically active because they're in pain and they're confused, or more politically active because they're angry and they want to change?
I think it's difficult to say. I only can tell from the kind of anecdotal evidence from what I read in the newspapers, because, of course, that was not part of the study, and it's difficult to actually relate individual decisions, what to do, to the economic circumstances. But, of course, one does think that in general terms, people who are unhappy in the long term would eventually become politically active. And, in a democracy, and even in non-democracies, as we have seen in the Middle East, things can actually look very stable and very similar from year to year until there is a change. So, I think that in the longer term, that kind of unhappiness or discontent is not politically totally sustainable.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Branko Milanovic.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure was mine, too. Again, I've been speaking with Branko Milanovic, who is a lead economist in the World Bank's research group and a visiting professor at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His work focuses on income distribution, poverty, and political economy of reform, and he's the author of The Haves and Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with George Ferrer, the head of the group called Open Debates, who are trying to take away the monopoly on the debates from the Republican and Democratic parties.
It was us to carry them when we finally got it figured out that we had truly missed the boat.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is George Ferrer, who is the founder and executive director of Open Debates, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization working to reform the presidential debates so that they better serve the interests of the American people. He's the author of No Debate: How the Republican and Democratic Parties Secretly Control the Presidential Debates. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Ferrer.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And it's pretty clear that that the game is rigged, that the two parties have taken it over. They took it over from the League of Women Voters. And when did that happen? Back in the 1980s, wasn't it?
Exactly. The League of Women Voters ran the presidential debates and did a fantastic job with it from 1976 until 1984. And they were on the verge of sponsoring the 1988 presidential debates when the commission absolutely seized control and has permanently run the presidential debates ever since.
And this commission is made up of whom?
It's remarkable. The Commission on Presidential Debates is unequivocally a tool of the two major parties. It was created by the Republican Party and the Democratic Party jointly. They actually ratified an agreement in 1986 to, quote, take over the presidential debates. And currently, there are two co-chairs. One is Frank Fahrenkopf. He's the former chair of the Republican Party and the nation's leading gambling lobbyist. And the other one is Mike McCurry, the former press secretary to Bill Clinton and a partner at a lobbyist firm in Washington. And these two gentlemen run the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is not, as it sounds, a government agency, but actually a private corporation, and make judgments about who can and cannot be seen on the most critical forums in our country.
So what – I know you're working to reverse this, but what can be done to overturn this rigged system that weakens that has weakened the format from the days of the League of Women Voters, so it's much more staged and less spontaneous, and you don't get more of a chance to find out who these people are, limiting the number of debates – what, there's only three, right?
Right, three presidential, one vice presidential,
and then excluding third party candidates. So let's walk us through those three.
Well, I think a fascinating way to understand just how bad things have got is to see how fantastic things were under the League. You know, so the League of Women Voters is a wonderful nonprofit, kind of true American, old school nonprofit that's committed to the democratic process. It serves no interest other than the voters' education. And they've consistently stood up to the major parties when the major parties have imposed rules and regulations that come at the expense of our democratic process. For example, in 1980, former Republican Congressman John Anderson decided to run as an independent for president. He was gathering substantial attention in the polls, a good number of a substantial amount of money, but President Jimmy Carter, then president at the time, absolutely refused to debate him. And the League chose to stand up to the President of the United States. Rather than disinvite John Anderson, they held a debate between Republican nominee Ronald Reagan, the independent candidate John Anderson, and an empty chair to signify the President of the United States wasn't going to be there and should have been there. And at the it's immediately clear from 1980 and from then on that the League was not going to mess around. They were going to stand up to the candidates and be our advocate in the negotiating room. If you fast forward 4 years later, the Walter Mondale and Ronald Reagan campaigns attempted to manipulate the format and get rid of all the difficult questions. The League proposed a number of journalists to ask questions during the debates. But Walter Mondale's campaign and Ronald Reagan's campaign vetoed 80 journalists, vetoed 80 of the suggestions in a row that the League proposed. Well, the League was outraged. They didn't acquiesce to the candidates' proposals. Instead, they held a press conference and lambasted the candidates for abusing the process and trying to get rid of difficult questions. So, of course, the candidates for the next debate, with their tails between their legs, had to accept the League's proposals. And finally, the third kind of example of the League standing up for our interest in the face of overwhelming party oppression, in 1988, the two candidates negotiated a contract, a secret contract that would dictate how the debates would be structured. And they handed it to the League, Ian, and they said, League, implement this. And the League said, are you kidding me? We're not going to implement this contract. This is anti-democratic. This prohibits follow-up questions and eliminates the capacity for actual debate. And instead, they published the actual contract, held a press conference, and said they would not be an accessory to the hoodwinking of the American people. That's a direct quote. Well, of course, this was perfect for the commission, which had been created 2 years earlier. They were just happy being an accessory to the hoodwinking of the American people and assumed control over the presidential debates by implementing that contract. And ever since 1988, every 4 years, negotiators for the major party campaigns get together behind closed doors and negotiate these secret contracts that dictate how the debates will be structured, how many debates there will be, how the formats will be structured, and who can participate. And as a result, we're all paying an enormous price.
So in 88, that was George H.W. Bush and Dukakis, right? And,
exactly.
And that was, of course, that would have been done by that woman who's on CNN all the time, ran his campaign. No, actually, it was the Susan Estrich, the Quisling Democrat on Fox News. So, that doesn't surprise me. By the way, when you mentioned Carter being an empty chair, it's worth noting that Carter lost to Ronald Reagan, right?
He did. He did, and in no small part because he looked very cowardly avoiding that critical debate. That's what the League could do. It could leverage public opinion, civic group opinion, and press opinion on their behalf, because who's going to oppose their fundamentally democratic mission, which is for inclusive and aggressive debates? And the commission does the exact opposite. Rather than marshal the support of the public, it spits in the face of public opinion. It excludes candidates that the majority of voters want to see. It eliminates challenging formats that might threaten or antagonize the candidates. And it confines the number of debates. Every single contract that the major party candidates have drafted under the commission's tenure has explicitly stated that the candidates will only participate in the three debates hosted by the Commission on Presidential Debates, meaning all the other civic groups out there, from the NAACP to the NRA, are fundamentally precluded from actually hosting a debate, which is ridiculous. At a time when we're facing stubbornly high unemployment, a massive fiscal crisis, very difficult foreign policy changes, why should we be rationing debates? It doesn't make any sense, Ian.
Again, I'm speaking with George Ferrer, who is the founder and executive director of Open Debates, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization working to reform the presidential debates so that they better serve the interests of the American people. He's the author of No Debate, How the Republican and Democratic Parties Secretly Control the Presidential Debates. Now, I host the UCLA Hammer Forum in Los Angeles, and we had a couple of third-party candidates, Rocky Anderson and Buddy Roma, recently, and Buddy Roma was in this race on the Republican side, and he qualified for the debates, but they kept changing the rules, and they kept arbitrarily making it more and more difficult to keep him out of the race, because you know he set a limit of $100 per donor, and was trying to run as a principled independent candidate, but they wouldn't let him on the stage. And I know why, because he was very effective.
The commission, it's one of the most effective propaganda tools that the commission deploys is the argument about third-party candidates. If you say to the commission, hey, your criteria, which by the way is 15%, in order to get into a debate hosted by the Commission on Presidential Debates, you must be polling on average at 15% in the polls. If you say to them, wait a minute, that's too high. You know, if you win 5% of the vote, Congress has stipulated that you get millions of dollars in taxpayer funds. Why should the standard to get in the debates be three times higher than the standard to actually get taxpayers' funds? It doesn't make any sense to have taxpayers financing a candidate that they can't even see. And if you confront the commission with this evidence and other evidence to suggest that candidates should be included, they say, oh, wait a minute. there are hundreds of crazy third-party candidates out there, from, you know, Billy Joe Clegg of the Clegg Won't Pull Your Leg Party to Bob Crustacean of the Crustacean Liberation Party, and we can't have a stage that accommodates 200 candidates all spouting nonsense. Ian, this is absolute myth. It's not true. The reality is there has never, in the last 100 years, been more than seven candidates in a given election year that have qualified to even be on enough ballots to actually have a mathematical chance of winning the presidency. So even if you invited all of them, you'd have seven. And if you just say, wait a minute, why don't we let the American people decide? Instead of the commission, some private secretive corporation, let's ask the American people, who do you want in the debates? Well, when they're asked, they've never wanted more than four. They've always, you know, they wanted Ralph Nader in the debates. They wanted Pat Buchanan in the debates. They wanted Ross Perot. They're not going to select candidates that aren't having any popular support. So it's very arrogant and fundamentally anti-democratic for the commission to be arguing that somehow we as voters are incapable of selecting the participants in these forums.
Well, Perot did get in. That was the last time there was a third candidate in a debate, wasn't it?
Yeah, and to me, the story of what happened next is arguably the most fascinating story in presidential debate history. You know, in 1992, Perot gets in, and he gets in only because President George H.W. Bush somehow thought that Perot would take more votes away from Clinton than him, and it ended up being a costly mistake strategically. Well, fast forward 4 years later, Perot was widely seen as the winner of the 1992 presidential debates, and as a result of the amount of votes that he got, he qualified for $37 million in taxpayer funds for 1996. 73% of the American people wanted to see him in the 1996 presidential debates when he ran again for office. But Bob Dole and Bill Clinton hatched a secret agreement to keep Perot out. Dole was desperate to keep Perot out because he thought that Perot would take more votes away from him. And Bill Clinton, who was comfortably leading in the polls, didn't want anyone watching the debates. George Stephanopoulos told me he wanted it to be a non-event. And so here's the deal they hatched. Clinton agreed to exclude Perot on the condition that they canceled one of the three debates and scheduled the remaining two debates opposite the World Series of Baseball. And so what you have is voters turn on the TV, there was no Perot, you had two debates instead of three, follow-up questions were banned, and those two debates were scheduled opposite the World Series, all because the Dole and Clinton campaigns had secretly concocted this negotiated contract. And no one had any idea, because the private corporation called the commission took the heat and concealed the contract. To me, that's an outrage.
Well, just in the last minute then, George Ferrer, the Commission on Presidential Debates just announced the selection of CNN's Candy Crowley, PBS's Jim Lehrer, and CBS's Bob Schieffer as the moderators of the three presidential debates, and ABC's Martha Raddatz will host the one and only vice presidential debate. A lot of people are yawning at that. It's those choices. Why not have people like Keith Olbermann and Rush Limbaugh? Why stick to these establishment figures?
For the very simple reason that candidates are by definition risk averse and they're terrified of difficult questions where they might stumble on camera. And so long as the candidates are exerting this much control over the process, they're going to make sure that no one like Keith Olbermann or, you know, the late Tim Russert, who was maybe more mainstream and had the courage to ask difficult questions, is ever going to moderate an actual presidential debate. It's not going to happen so long as the candidates are controlling the process, because they're terrified to look foolish on camera. So instead, you end up with Jim Lehrer, who's hosting the presidential debates for the 12th time, and whose questions are absolutely predictable. So the candidates can memorize responses before the debate and just unload their 30 or 90-second sound bites during the debate rather than actually be challenged on their record or forced to actually talk to each other.
Well, George Ferrer, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with George Ferrer, who is the founder and executive director of Open Debates, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization working to reform presidential debates so that they better serve the interests of the American people. He's the author of No Debate, How the Republican and Democratic Parties Secretly Control the Presidential Debates. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Farah Mohammed. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, and I'll be back on Sunday at 11 with another background briefing. Bye for now.